Happy spring, or depending where you are, almost spring. Today, it's goats, and there are so many good reasons to raise goats, and with over 20 years' experience, Greg Christensen from Grandview Livestock and Ranch is with us to share some of those reasons and quite a bit of know-how. Foraging, or also called wildcrafting, is centered on a balance between humans and nature, ethical and sustainable consumption, respect, and basically acknowledging a true relationship with the land. And Sue Marchese is with us to lend her expertise. And I'm Robin Clare.
For Cultivated Audio, April 2023.
Tell us some of the basics about your operation at Grandview Ranch in Parker, Kansas. The landscape and acreage, types and numbers of livestock, and basic geography or rainfall.
Robin, it's good to talk to you this morning. It's a little hard to count sheep and goats, and it varies from day to day sometimes. But I'd say we have a neighborhood of 900 breeding nannies and probably about 900 breeding ewes, more or less. They're not like cattle. You don't go out and count them every day and realize you're missing one and go looking for them. And then we do farm row crops also, and that takes up the rest of our time, I guess. We get probably 36 or 8 inches of rainfall a year. The pastures can be split up. We would have some pastures that would be maybe as small as 40 acres, and then some larger that's maybe 500 acres. In the larger pastures, we would have split in maybe 80-acre paddocks. Our time's kind of split right now between kidding and lambing, which is not quite started yet. It'll be just a few days, and we'll be in that season, and we're planting soybeans and corn. Probably our busiest time of year, or second busiest, maybe fall is also busy. But I say that every day, though, so every day is busy.
Right. Having both goats and sheep, maybe you can give us a little outline of a year, your schedule, how sure. It does fall. I feel fortunate mm-hmm. that I did catch you right in time, didn't I? Right before the goats and the sheep are going to hit the fan, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll be kidding and lambing. We'll officially start on May 1st. You get a few that come early. Over the years, I've moved it to May 1st. I used to do it in March, and I moved it to April. But it's all dependent on weather.
Of course.
And if you have good weather, it's easier, it's less labor, it's less stressful on the animals. Because when a 4-pound kid hits the ground and he goes from 102-degree temperature out of inside the nanny, and if the ground is 40 degrees even, and it's rainy and cold, they don't have enough body mass to stay warm for very long. So they got to get up and get to sucking right away. So we just backed it up May 1st. That'll probably take to the end of May, maybe. They're pretty quick about lambing and kidding all at once. And then probably around, we like to say the 4th of July, it could be the 10th of July, but no later than the 15th. We're bringing them all in, nannies and kids. We need to castrate the males at that time, because if you don't, they'll actually start breeding the females that's out in the pasture with them. And that would give you like a December or January kid, and you don't want that.
Right.
At that time, we're also giving them a vaccination. It's called CD&T. It's somewhat like a blackleg shot in cattle. So we're going to give that, and we give another vaccination for pneumonia. So that'll be their first vaccination. And we'll check everyone for parasites at that time. One of the probably the biggest killer of sheep and goats is parasites. Parasites are more serious in them than it is in cattle. They suck their blood. So we look at their eyelids to see if they might be anemic. And if their eyelids are bright red, that's good. And then from that color, it stair steps down to white, and that's bad. they're anywhere from that middle range down to white, we would worm those. And we would check the kids also. And then we just worm the ones that need it. We don't worm everyone. There's a real problem in the sheep and goat industries that our wormers are running out of efficacy, that are not as effective as they used to be because parasites get immune to them over time. And then we'll leave them on their mothers. If they have good forage where they're at, we might leave them on. We left them on until December before. If they don't have good forage, we might wean them off, let's say, September. The great thing about sheep and goats is they're not trying to breed back while they have a lamb on them or sucking them or a kid. See, we wouldn't breed that ewe now until December 1st. We'll put the bucks and rams in. And so it's a five-month gestation. And so 5 months from then would be May 1st.
Full circle.
Yeah, so they've got plenty of time to recoup. And even if we leave those kids or lambs on them till December, they've kind of weaned them themselves by that time. They're gaining weight, and they're in good shape to rebreed. But we want to make sure they have adequate forage. That's why we bring some of the kids or lambs. Maybe we would wean them earlier. And then the ones we bring home, we would like to have some kind of forage growing for them. It could be, you know, Sudan grass, Austrian winter peas, or some kind of summer mix that we planted in May. And then our native fescue grass is growing also by that time, let's say September-ish. You know, we try to stockpile that, and it's pretty good feed there in the fall because we want them to continue growing. But we don't market them until any time from, let's just say, mid-December until Easter. That would be our marketing season. You want them to be in good flesh. You want them to be fat. When you sell them, the optimum weight to sell a kid, a goat, would say be 60 to 70 pounds. Now, if you're a goat buyer, you probably like to buy them about 55. But if you're a goat seller, you want to put more weight on them than that to actually get the most dollars out of them. But if you get it over 70, sometimes you just have to watch the market, because then they'll start docking you more heavily, so it doesn't pay for the feed to get them any heavier at a certain point. You just have to watch that. You want them as heavy as you can get them, but still please the buyers.
If they get up to 70 plus, does that have any effect on the quality of the meat?
No, it doesn't really, especially the goats. They don't want an 80 or 90 pound kid. It's just too much to feed the family. It has more to do with that than the flavor of the meat, really.
Gotcha. How did you settle on having a majority of sheep and goats? I know in the past you've had cattle.
Well, honestly, it comes down to profitability. And once you have the infrastructure set up for small ruminants, you got the biggest expense in that. So we already had it set up, and our cow herd was getting older. We had more sheep and goats, you know, that we're raising for replacements every year. We still take in on a custom basis, custom grazing, some cows, because to have some cows benefits the sheep and goats, because they kind of mop up the parasites that the sheep and goats get.
Mm.
Those parasites don't bother the cows, and the cow parasites don't bother the sheep and goats.
So what are the benefits of having sheep and goats? Are they able to graze all in the same fields?
Well, we do graze them in the same fields. They'll eat, you know, weeds. The goats are better at eating woody brush, or like buck brush, or we call them hedge trees here, or wardark, or Osage orange, locust tree, anything with a thorn on it, they love it. Any multiflower rose bushes, they eat. They'll defoliate them, and then they'll eventually die out. I honestly kind of hate to see that stuff die out, because it's good goat feed.
Right.
Places that we had goats, I've had goats for 20 years. Well, I started losing a lot of the brush, in my goat pastures. So we turned those into sheep pastures. About 5 years ago, I got into sheep, and they're hair sheep. So these sheep don't have wool. They shed their hair. And so with our goats, we put a lot of our goats on other people's property that want brush control.
Right.
That's a win-win. They like that. They don't have to bush hog their pasture, spray their brush. Because here in Kansas, you know, it'll take over a pasture if you don't do something. So, yeah, we go in and fence those with electric fence. And so we'll run goats on those places and have sheep on some of our own pastures that we either own or rent.
Somewhere along the way, I saw that you were talking about the no-cost grazing land, and share some about that. You were just mentioning the goats eating the brushy stuff right down to the nib. Is there a way that you can move them before they actually mow it all down, so to speak, and then it'll grow back? Or do you just basically let them go after that woody, thorny type of plant?
We do some grazing management, rotational grazing. It's harder to do when we have goats on someone else's property that they have the cows on, because they may not want cross fences going all over their property.
See? Right, understood, sure.
But they don't want to have to get their bush hog out, their mower out, pull over the tractor, and come out there. It's expensive and time-consuming. So we would just let them eat that down, but we kind of manage that with the number of goats we would put on that property. For instance, if there's a, let's just say, 80 acres, a guy wants us to put goats on it to manage that brush, we would come in and fence it. Now, you have to have some economical fencing to afford to do this, because we pay for all the fencing. And we use one electric wire around the perimeter of the pasture, and just up, boot top high, let's say. And we put that up. The cost of it is not very much. And we put it up because we want to know how it's put up. We're responsible for keeping the animals in.
Right.
And so we take care of that fence. And the landowner or the person that has cows on it loves that fence there because his cows don't get out anymore.
Mm.
And so they don't want us to leave if no other reason than just because our fence is there, because we stayed at the beginning. If we leave or you don't need us here anymore, we're taking the fence with us. It's our fence. You know, in those situations, we may have, let's say on that 80, we may have, 80 goats on it the first year. And they do a pretty good job of, you know, getting that brush down. Maybe the second year we have the same number, but then as years go on, we taper that number off so they're not infringing upon his grass for his cows, see?
Right, yes.
We call it leaving a maintenance crew there.
Mm.
So, you know, we might have 30 nannies on there and their kids after, let's say, 5 years. A lot of these deals I've had 15 years.
That's a great.
And we keep them there every day of the year for the most part. And a lot of times those pastures are maybe split in half or something. He puts his cows on one half and feeds them hay. And we put our goats on the other half and feed them hay. And if they're not split, I put hay out for my goats. I kind of know how much hay, let's say 100 goats would eat. And he puts hay out for his cows. And if his cows eat some of my hay and my goats eat some of his, we get along.
Yes, yes.
I don't do this deal with people I don't think I can get along with, because there's just a lot of give and take.
So. Oh, of course, yes. And it's a great give and take between the cattle, mm-hmm. certainly, and the goats. Is there a breed or breeds that you settled on for specifically raising the goat meat? And how specific would that be to Kansas?
I wouldn't say any breed is terribly specific to Kansas. The breed I started out with was called Boar, and you see a lot of those. They're white with the red head. You see them in a lot of county fairs or 4-H. They're really great. If you were going to raise 4-H kids or have your kids have a project or something, those are the goats you would want.
Mm.
If you were going to raise them as cattle, like cattle out on pasture, it didn't work for me. I'm sure there's people that are doing that successfully, and it works probably better in a drier climate. They're not as parasite resistant or resilient, maybe. And they come from a drier climate of South Africa. So we started using a breed called Kiko. Kiko is from the New Zealand area, higher rainfall area. They're kind of a feral goat or a wild goat that people caught and brought over here and then started to breed up for them. They were more resilient, better mothers than what we experienced with the boar. And then there's the myotonic goat, the fainting goat. So we've used some crosses of those. I like those real well. They're really muscular, and if you cross them with something, they don't faint. If you startle them, they'll just stiffen up and fall over.
Oh, my gosh.
Kind of humorous.
A cruel trick.
But yeah. So when I would gather them with my border collie, she'd run out there, and of course, some of them would fall over, and she'd look up at me like, I don't know. I didn't think I killed it. But The Kikos are kind of tall and lanky. The myotonics were shorter and muscular, so we crossed them with that. And Spanish goats also. There is a Spanish goat registered breed. Now, around most places, they call anything a Spanish goat. When I was first buying goats, anything that wasn't some other breed was called a Spanish goat. They've kind of got away from that. So now that maybe that's called a brush goat, if you don't know what breed it is. But a true Spanish goat is an actual breed. There's probably more differences within any of those breeds than there are in the breed itself.
Oh, you know, they're all good mothers.
They're all somewhat parasite resistant, but you still have to keep an eye on that.
Right. How many dogs per number of goats or sheep do you have?
So we have, you know, several pastures. Every pasture would have at least two dogs. I wouldn't have a dog by one dog by itself. The coyotes are so smart, they will come in, three or four coyotes, and lure the dog away.
Ooh.
And they come in and get the kids. Now, they're not too hard on the adult ewes and nannies, but on the kids, especially during kidding time, yeah, it's pretty serious. So we might have, we've got a group of 500 sheep with six dogs in them. Another group of nannies with, say, 300 in that group with five dogs in them. And a goat, you have to have more dogs because a goat is real bad, or it's just their nature, to hide their kid off someplace. And that place might be a quarter mile away. And somehow they tell that kid, you know, lay down and be quiet, and they go off and graze with the herd. So it could be coyote meet there. So you got to have plenty of dogs, and hopefully they kind of know where mama laid their babies and things, but always more than one, but some cases up to five or six.
What would you call or say is your biggest blunder or perhaps learning opportunity that you've had?
I don't know if I could narrow it down to one. Probably just realizing how bad the predator pressure is. We're not getting them up until, let's say like 4th of July. We have no idea how many are born in this pasture until we get them up then, and then we take inventory, we count, okay. Well, I'm sure we've lost a lot that we don't know of, and so we're realizing that now even more so. In some places we're using electric fence. I don't know if you've heard of Smart Fence by Gallagher. We're using that Smart Fence on a group of 500 ewes. We're fencing them with the Smart Fence to keep them close together while they're lambing, and the dogs can protect them better.
Right.
It's as much for the dogs' benefit and the ewes and lambs. And then also to give them better forage and to keep them more parasite-free as we move them every couple of days, see?
Yeah, well, I know the mob grazing is popular with cattle. Is that a similar scenario for goats or sheep?
Yeah, that's what we're actually trying to do with this one group. Like I said, we can't do that on a lot of groups where they're on somebody else's property. And,
right.
You know, I figured out it cost us probably another $12 a ewe if we do that every day of the year. We won't do it every day, but it adds to the cost, just the labor of it, you know. And then you've got to have a watering system. We haul water to those. It should be worth it. We'll find out.
Right. Now, as the sustainable and regenerative movement gets rolling, are there any efforts in that direction that you've experienced as being worthwhile or getting positive results from with sheep and goats?
Yeah, well, your pastures will change. Of course, some of the woody brush that you might have thought was a nuisance, it'll leave. They won't all leave at once, but it depends the size of it. You know, they're not going to kill out a 6-inch tree or even a 4-inch tree, but the pasture maintenance is a lot less, and you'll start looking at your pasture different. What I used to think was a weed, now I feel like, well, that's sheep and goat feed.
Right, yes.
You know, I see somebody spraying their pasture or something, and I'll see them somewhere say, hey, man, you're killing my goat feed. your pastures will change, and that's another reason that we've kind of taken some of these cows, because our grass is a lot better than it was. And ewes will eat quite a bit of grass. The goats will eat some if they're forced to. It's not their first choice. And here at home, we've got pastures split up into, let's say, 5-acre-ish paddocks, you know, with a watering system. Yeah, we're growing, I'd say, 50% or maybe 100% more forage than we did before we split those paddocks up and rotated through them. On some crop ground, let's say we would normally grow soybeans there, but we need to rotate to another crop because you'll get some disease in your soybeans and deplete some of the nutrients that soybean if you just continue to plant soybeans. Well, okay, so around here, many people might go to corn. Sometimes corn isn't very economical in our area. We don't get big yields like up in Iowa or somewhere. So we might plant that to some kind of a grazing crop, a multi-species grazing crop, and then graze that through the summer with our sheep and goats. And then we can go back to beans. It's more of our moneymaker crop, you might say, in this area the next year. And so, you know, it changes the soil, organic matter. We've seen a lot, I would say, over the years. I didn't start doing that at first. It's only probably been in the last 7-8 years that we've managed the cover cropping with our livestock as much.
Right, but certainly you are seeing the positive changes. Now, I'm wondering for people and yourself, obviously, who raise goats for meat sales, do you get milk yourself? Do you use the goat milk and make yogurt or cheese or anything like that?
No, it's sort of like cattle.
Okay.
There's a milk breed of goats.
Gotcha.
So this is more of a meat breed. If you were going to get into milking, you would use a different breed of animals. And I told my wife a long time ago, I would never do is run a restaurant or run a dairy. So you just got to be there all the time. You know,
yes,
those two things
yes.
Just look like, yeah, I never wanted to do that.
But, understood.
You know, I think
my dad had a restaurant, and I know of what you speak. Yes. That was one of his businesses anyway. He was also a farmer. And what piece of advice comes to mind right now to share with someone who's either just starting out with goats and or sheep or are thinking about getting started?
Well, I would say that the hardest thing about getting into goats is finding good goats. Let's say you're someone with 10 acres and you want to raise a few goats and you got some chickens and a few other things, you want to go to someone that has a similar management style, because my goats probably would do very good for you in that setting. They're more, now if you was going to raise goats on, you know, maybe 80 acres or 40 or something, they're going to treat them more like cows, then you want to go to somebody that would have that kind of management system. And the smaller management systems, I would probably even look at the boar goat. They're very muscular and they sell very well at the sale barn. Or if you're direct marketing or something,
mm-hmm.
and under a smaller management system, they do real well. So I would go to somebody that's raising them like what you want to do. Same environment, too.
Would you recommend to anyone that the Spanish goat is very specifically something that's sought after, and so they bring a higher price? Raising them would be a specialty or a niche market?
If you're going to raise breeding stock, the Spanish goat would just be one. You could raise breeding stock in the boar goat business, Kiko goat business. Good nannies are really valuable.
Mm.
And they're very hard to find. People ask, where would I go to find them? And basically, nobody sells them, because if you go to the sale barn, and there's several within, a couple hours from me, let's say there's three or four. And if you took a nanny in there, she might only bring $150, $175 there, okay? If she has a kid, the kids are going to go in there and bring probably over $200. So a 60-pound kid, let's say it's $4 a pound on the hoof. That's $240 for one. Well, who's going to sell a good nanny for $175 or $150 when they could produce a kid and maybe
right.
two of them that's worth over $200?
Gotcha.
So what you find at the sale barn is usually somebody that has a bad bag, or they're old, their teeth are no good.
Mm.
There's a reason that they're there.
Right.
See?
So that's a very good tip.
So if you're going to try to start and you must go to the sale barn, I would look for some young doelings, some that's just been weaned or something, and maybe that producer couldn't keep all of it he wanted.
Sure.
And then you keep those. And we don't even feed our doelings the first year. It just works out better for us if we breed them and have them kid as two-year-olds. And so I tell people, I'll buy you a nine-month-old doeling and get used to it. Let them get used to your place, and then breed that to have a kid at 2 years old. And by that time, you know if you've got fence enough for them and how to handle them. And
okay, last question. Do you have a favorite way to cook goat meat? Are you a fan of cabrito? Or
we've eaten it, but that meat, it's really expensive. So we don't eat much goat, no. And that meat hits somebody's plate, it's probably $15 a pound or something.
Gotcha.
So we would sell the goat and buy a good steak maybe or something. Nothing wrong with goat meat. It's just that it's pricier than I would go to the store and buy it for you. Even if we raised ourselves, it's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not that much on a carcass. One time we had a, 50-pound goat, and we had a broken leg on it. And so we did butcher it. We made it into jerky. It made 5 pounds of jerky, the whole goat.
Mm.
And so that was some expensive jerky. You know?
Yes, well, you savor every bite in that case, right?
Yeah. But I'd recommend for small producers or large producers running with their cows, goats are a great benefit to the pasture, and goats don't kick you, goats don't run over you. They're easy for the kids to handle. We don't make ours pets, but they can become pets if you want them to be.
I hear birds in the background, so that's been lovely.
It's a nice day here in Kansas today.
Sue, it's sometimes wise and sometimes sustainable to keep one's favorite foraging area under wraps. So without divulging, tell us about your recent week-long trip into the wilds of Idaho. And were you looking for certain plants, or is this the time of year you are doing that sort of thing?
So with some of the plants, I have particular places that I go, and I never do keep secret any of my places. Anything I know is open to anyone. I'm really happy to share my places and my knowledge. So I have a couple of rules about going to any place, not just mine. The basic thing is, for sustainability, you step over four of the plants and pick the fifth one. In other words, don't go in and just pick everything that you see that you might want. And of course, that rule is not completely always. It depends some on the plant. If I take people to the woods with me, I'll only take two or three at a time, or one. I won't take a crowd, because we tend to trample too much ground if we do that.
tell us about your recent trip out to the woods to camp for a while. Were you going for some early solace, or are there plants that are early popping up that you were looking for this time of year?
So we've had a very, very strange winter and spring here. There's still in my yard 2 feet of snow.
Oh, my gosh. So I
have to go to a lower elevation to find anything right now. My camping trip out was several reasons. I needed to be by myself for a bit. I was hoping to pick several. I have one place that I go where I can get usually a dozen plants, enough for an entire year in one weekend. It's really an incredible spot.
Yes, yeah, sounds like it.
I got this time 2 plants. That was it. And enough for a year, yes. But it wasn't very successful that way. But I had a great time. Camping was great.
All right. Do you want to tell us about those 2 plants that you got? Like, how much is a year supply for you? What do you do with those plants and that sort of thing? That'd be great.
Okay, so what I got this time was rose hips, which I think most everybody knows are good for colds. It's very incredible vitamin C. I got some for a friend who does tincture them. I only dry them. I use them for tea. The products that I make are tinctures, which is an alcohol base, salves, which is oil and beeswax plus whatever plants I'm putting in, capsules, which is just ground up plants in capsules, and teas. I prefer for myself teas because I don't like the alcohol. The teas are easily the cheapest thing to make because you pick the plant and you dry it. There's no added anything to it. And I love the taste of all of these plants. So I got rose hips to make tea for me and to tincture for my friend. I got watercress, which I love.
Yes.
Partly I use the watercress just like in salads and sandwiches and things like that. But partly watercress is a very, very good medicinal. It's good for nervousness, headaches. It's a cancer aid, anti-tumor properties. Dermatological, eczema and dermatitis is cured with watercress. It's a good diuretic. It helps your kidneys and your liver and your lungs and your stomach. All of those things can be helped by eating watercress. And I love the taste of it. That's the main thing.
Yes.
And by the way, we've made some pretty incredible Bloody Marys by tincturing the watercress in the vodka, and you get that little bite of the watercress with it. They're really good. I'm not a drinker.
That sounds great.
Well, I also, on that trip, picked up some dead Osage orange. Now, Osage orange is not wild here, but I have a buddy, well, he's dead long ago now, but he went to Kansas and picked Osage oranges because he liked the trees, and brought them back and planted them at my spot.
Mm.
And so now I have a couple of buddies who do a lot of very beautiful woodworking, and they're using the Osage orange wood in their woodworking. I only take what's dead. I don't ever cut anything fresh. And then the oranges, by the way, are good for soap. They make very, very good soap. So I guess I got 3 things. Not on purpose.
So how much of the rose hip did you get?
Rose hips, I got about 4 gallons.
Oh, okay. So that's a good year supply. That's good to know. And then with your teas, do you make infusion teas or do you just make tea?
I just make tea. I mean, I put the dried up leaves in a teapot and cover them with not quite boiling water. Boiling water will eliminate medicinal properties, so you should never make tea with boiling water. That's it. Let it steep for 10 minutes and drink it up.
All right. Now, I'd imagine that each plant has a way and a time to be harvested sustainably? And does the look of the plant give clues as to what that time is, or should we harvest bulbs or the roots only after it's gone to seed so we can, you know, maybe replant some seeds? How do you do that?
Okay, that's a very good question. A lot of the plants can be harvested any time that they're up. And like I say, where I live, we get 5 or 6 feet of snow through the winter. So there's not much harvesting that goes on. We have to kind of cram it in through the summertime. I do my best to only gather things within 50 miles of where I live. And why is that? I'm not sure. Maybe I just don't want to drive that far away for my things. Maybe I feel like where I live in central Idaho mountains is probably one of the very richest herbal areas in the whole world. Amazing. We work with about 300 plants that we harvest within 50 miles of here. So why go far away when it's right here?
Absolutely. You said that you will walk past 4 or 5 plants and then pick one. Are there some that you might just cut down rather than take out by the root? And is there a general rule about how much you would leave? Ranchers, for instance, will move cattle into another pasture once they've nibbed down to a certain point with the grasses so they can regrow again.
With the plants, it very, very much depends on the plants. There are some things that we only pick just the flowering top, no more. And that way the plant can keep on producing even that year, it can get more. There are several things, like I'm thinking of 4 different things right now, that what we use is the roots. You destroy the whole plant by digging up the roots. And that's more of where we do the step over 4 and pick the last one. There are some where we just use leaves. So we'll just pick the leaves off of the plant and the plant continues to grow. There's no good reason to run around just pulling up things that you don't need the roots for.
Right, nor ones that you don't really know what they're good for.
Oh, yeah. I don't run around picking wildflowers just to put on the table, partly because I live outside, so why bother? But partly those flowers are hopefully going to turn into seeds, and we don't need to be destroying that part of what we have. I mean, we're so very lucky to have the plants that we have. There is not a good reason to mess with what's going on except for what little bit I need for medicinal purposes.
Right. So do you always have a plant's medicinal use in mind when you're out foraging?
Yes. Yes, I always have a plan. And I do figure when I go out, I have an idea of what I'm looking for, what I want to get. If I don't happen to find those and run into other things, that's always great too. It's a good surprise to get things that I didn't expect to get that day.
Right. Now, tell us about one of your favorite herbs that you collect, when and how you collect it and how you prepare its use. And I know it's kind of like saying, who's your favorite child? But maybe you can just pick one that is a favorite.
That is an easy one. I do have a favorite child.
Okay.
If I could only have one plant ever, if somebody said, okay, you can go pick stuff, but you can only pick one plant, it would always be yarrow. Wow. Yarrow is extremely prolific. Most everybody, even if you don't know the name of it, you see the plant and you say, oh yeah, I know that one. It's a sweet little plant. It grows around here about 1 foot or 15 inches tall. The leaves are very lacy and pretty. The flowering umbel is white with yellow centers in clumps, lots of flowers on one. It's good for more things than any other plant that I have. Yarrow takes care of headaches. It will coagulate your blood. It lowers blood pressure or regulates, even if you have low blood pressure. It will regulate your blood pressure so it can put it up or put it down, whatever you need. It makes a very, very good tea for colds. Also, I have a wood stove and I'll put the yarrow plant dried on top of the wood stove and let it smoke and clears out my sinuses. Mm. It's great for them. It gets rid of fevers, hot flashes, bug bites and bee stings and such things. If you pick a couple or three leaves and chew them up, and they taste horrible. It's really, really a bitter taste. But chew them up, swallow the juice, and put the chewed up leaf on the sting site. It will prevent swelling. It'll take the pain away. It'll be healed up in just a matter of a few minutes. It's an amazing thing that way.
It is
amazing.
You
just have to get used to chewing that horrible taste.
Right. Mm. Chinese teas help with that, right?
It heals up any kind of wounds. And my good story about that one is I have wolves, and one of the wolves got in a fight with a cougar, and the cougar really tore up his face. This is going to sound funny. I chewed up the yarrow leaves and plastered them all over his face and taped them on with duct tape. And I took the tape off, actually, the next day and just used yarrow salve afterwards. And in 3 days, those wounds were all healed up. I mean, you could still see the scars, but the yucky part was all gone. It was great.
That is amazing. And the other amazing thing is, which you just glossed over, is saying, I have wolves. I mean,
yes,
not everyone I speak to has wolves. So do tell, how did that come about?
So I'm on my fourth wolf right now. They've all been given to me for different reasons. People couldn't hold on to them and let me have them. One family that I knew were raising wolves, but the brave fence jumper Australian Shepherd came in, and they needed to get rid of those pups because they wanted pure wolf, not half and half.
Mm.
And if I were to have real dogs, Aussies would be my choice. They're sweet dogs. Anyway, so I'm 71. I've had dogs my entire life, and I've never had anything that was so kind, so smart, such good companions as the wolves have been. They're just incredible animals.
So there you go.
There's my wolf story.
That's wonderful. Let's go back to the yarrow just for a moment, Sue, and tell us, you mentioned the leaves. So is that what you pick from the yarrow? Do you ever use the yarrow flower or?
I use the flowers and the leaves equally the same. I don't see any difference in the constituents of them, which is not the same with all plants. One of my favorite plants is mullein, just because every piece of the mullein plant is used for different conditions, different problems. The roots are good for your stomach. The leaves are good for colds and lung things.
Yes, it's very good for the lungs, I know for sure.
You bet, yeah.
Yeah.
The flowers infused in oil, and I tend to use mostly all coconut oil. I like the way that it soaks in best. It's a little more expensive than using olive oil, but they won't go bad. They don't turn rancid.
Right. That's good to know about the coconut oil. I use it for many things, but I wouldn't have thought to use it for infusing herbs, so thank you for that.
You betcha. So the flowers they get rid of earaches. The seeds get rid of cramps.
So making a tea with the seeds, you mean, or?
Making a tea with the seeds or a tincture.
Mm, yes.
Either one.
Mm-hmm.
So I love it that each piece of that plant does a different thing.
Yes.
Where with yarrow, the leaves and the flowers are all the same, and I throw the stems in just because I generally pick the whole part above ground. I don't take the roots of yarrow. I cut them off and then hang them around in my house to dry.
Right, yes.
And so then when I want parts of it, I just take a few stems.
Nice. This is a little off topic, but I'm wondering about invasive species of plants. I imagine they tend to grow in more disturbed areas than out in the wilds, which is sounding more and more like where you live. And I know they give the soil the help that the soil needs. There's a reason why they're there. But do you know if they have an obvious reason that fits into medicinal needs? And one thing I'm thinking of is back east, for instance, there are a lot of problems with ticks and Lyme disease. And I'm wondering if there are invasive species growing that have a medicinal purpose for alleviating or helping get rid of the Lyme disease.
Well, and so what I'll say about Lymes is we have a whole protocol, a Lyme protocol, and it's a book that's probably 80 pages long. So it's kind of hard to go into that in just a minute.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking about in general, really.
The invasive things, if they grow, they probably have a purpose in the ground. And one that I'm thinking of very much is horsetail. Horsetail cleans up the ground, as does thistles. They clean up the dirt. They take the bad stuff out of the dirt. And so if we're picking any of those types of things that are cleaners, you have to be kind of careful. I mean, I use a lot of horsetail because it's very, very good for arthritis, for your joints, any kind of joint problems. But I have to be very careful not to pick it in a place that has had mining in the old days when they used mercury.
Yes.
Because the horsetail is cleaning the mercury out of the soil, and you sure don't want to be feeding anybody mercury. Most of those invasives do have a purpose for why they grow somewhere. Cleaning the dirt, not so much medicinal, but cleaning the soil. And if you leave them alone, if you don't bother them, please, oh, please don't spray them. They generally will do their job and then they'll die off.
Right, yes.
And you can pull them. If you don't like them, pull them. But, oh, man, stay away from the sprays.
Right. Thank you.
I sound like an environmentalist, and I'm not. Those things drive me crazy.
Yes, just a wise woman here. And Sue, is there any other environmental or conscientious tip or thoughts you'd like to share before closing about what you're doing with herbs or what we all can do to wildcraft or forage in a conscientious way?
My warning is there are several plants that we have around here that there's one that is very, very medicinal, and then there's one that looks very much the same alike that is poison. So if you're going to go out and learn these things, please, oh, please know what you're up to. Be aware of what might be in your area that's not safe.
Gotcha.
And I know you make this brilliant bone vinegar. Can you share about that?
Okay, bone building vinegar. So I use very, very good apple cider vinegar that Steve provides.
The Fairchild, yes.
I put into it bone building stuff, which would be horsetail, stinging nettle, dandelion root and leaf, hound's tongue root and leaf. That's my formula. I let it soak for about 4 weeks, and then that's the only vinegar I use in my house for whatever. Salads, if you want to make sour milk, you pour vinegar into real milk. That's all I use. I do usually try and just straight drink about a tablespoon a day of it.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
For a few things. It fights off cramps, which I don't have. But I don't want them either.
Right.
So my mother used to get leg cramps at night.
Right.
And
yeah.
So I started her using it, and she said she never had another cramp. She just kept it by her bed. And
wow.
When she went to bed, she'd have a swig. Right. I am extremely lucky to live in a place where I can get all these things for free. It's a great excuse for the wolf and I to go play in the woods. I'm very, very lucky to have the knowledge, which has been gathered through a whole lot of different ways. And Jules lives in Northern California, and there are some of the plants that she likes to use that she can't get down there. I gather those for her, and she trades me for vodka.
I know. I just got to the tip of all of your knowledge, obviously. It was very evident.
So, Robin, thank you so much. I mean, this has been good fun, and I love sharing the knowledge. I really love being able to share it.
Wow. It just sounds very cool, the way you're living your life. So,
I love my life. I am extremely lucky. So I was thinking before you called, I was thinking about my life. And I was up at 5 this morning. I finished knitting a hat. I almost got finished with a quilt top. I did eat breakfast. I fed probably 300 birds and 3 dogs, not my own. I mean, my wolf also, but I have neighbor dogs who come and hang out here.
No doubt.
Now you, after you, I have 4 probation kids that I need to go and visit. I need to get a book on CD because tomorrow I have to go to Boise and it's 6 hours of driving. And I need to go plug in my sister's telephone because she has no idea how to do that. Isn't that craziness? This evening I will cook dinner for 2 men who are not my men. They're both ex-probation kids. One's 40 and one's 42.
Wow.
So that kind of tells you how long I've been playing this probation game.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I will sneak some weeds into their food if I feel like they need it.
It's so great to have these folks share a day in their life or 20 years of their life. So thank you very much to Sue Marchese and Greg Christensen for your awareness and for sharing it with us. We can be found at cultivatedaudio.com for any information. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be. Yes, and you too, Mr. Goat.